Bob Hughes, and I was born on the 9th of December 1945.
And where are we sitting now? What is this place that we're sitting in?
Okay, this is the Medino Cafe. And as far as I know, this place existed before 1962 and has not really changed in 40 years. It's now 2003. It's not really changed. These tables and the kitchen, more or less the same. Different owner,
right,
but more or less the same as it was.
This is on the Hinckley Road West.
Yeah, Hinckley Road.
Okay.
And it's probably one of the few, it might be the last, of all the old haunts that we used to go to in the 60s, in the early 60s at least.
And you were born around here, or did you live in this area? Was this a local?
No, I was born in Leicester. It would take, 15 minutes to walk to where I live from here.
Why would you come to this particular cafe rather than any other cafe?
Yes, well, that's a very good question. And I don't know why. I know they had a jukebox and down there somewhere, maybe where that machine is over there. They also had these little things on the wall, you know, that you could turn to Wurlitzer, and people were putting money in this thing all the time. And it was warm, and you could sit here for hours on end without buying much because we didn't have very much money.
So how old would you have been at this time?
Well, that's 17, maybe 16. I might have come here earlier than that.
And you were still at school?
College. I went to college. I went to Charles King College after school. We had a choice of either staying 2 years at school, or 3 years, or going to college for 2 years. And college appealed to me because, I don't know, they seemed to get results. And you didn't have to do things like religious training or PT or, you know, assembly. But more or less the same as school, same subjects.
Yeah,
I didn't leave there until I was 18. But we sort of, like the beatnik existence, all had ex-army whatever. Long hair, smoked these pipes. You know, tobacco is quite expensive, so I bought a tin of Erinmore mixture and St. Bruno, this stuff that smelt, you know, I mean, created this ambience that was, you either loved it or you hated it, a bit like a cigar. We didn't smoke because we liked the taste of it. It was to create, you know, first impressions of shock, I suppose. And me and Bart Archer, who incidentally nobody's heard of since about just after 1970, and I think he went to India and never came back, but nobody's quite sure. Bart was my best friend at the time. And then we met Jelly in here, either here or in the old Casa Valero, round about this time period, and first introductions to drugs. There was nothing going on in that, so it was a dead place. There's nothing open late at night, and all the information you got was on TV, and I mean that only started in about 1958 in black and white. I think it was 1958, something like that. Anyways. But only a few years, not very many people had a TV, so that wasn't really an option. And every Friday and Saturday night, there's huge queues outside the cinemas in Leicester, you know, to see the movie, to go to the movies. So it was a double feature, you know, a B movie, a few cartoons, and then a star movie. So that was about the limit of the entertainment. Oh, the Palais de Danse, people used to go there, and the Corn Exchange. 6-5 special. I don't think Ready Steady Go had even started then. I think it was a few years before that. And I remember him talking to me for a long time about jeans in general, because you could buy a pair of Levi's then at the Irish Linen. They were about 17 shillings a pair, I think, which was quite expensive compared with them. But there weren't jeans. There weren't any others, I don't think, at the time. No alternative. And jeans were regarded as something that you might work in, rather than anything to dress up in. I mean, after that, we all had a pair of Levi's. I remember I bought several pairs of Levi's, and they were the old stone things that shrank about 2 inches after you bought them, and you had to buy them a little bit big, and then wash them quite a few times to, you know, let them fade a bit and shrink, and then and it was a major disaster if you got the wrong size, because it needed to shrink as well as in the waist, in the leg, because it, to have them altered was horrendous. I mean, you just didn't get something like Levi's altered because the stitching was different and the shape of the leg and everything. So you had to put standard size. You say, oh, standard size. I think it was 30-inch waist and 30-inch inside leg, so I could step into an off-the-peg suit and it fit me perfectly. And so, I mean, they normally give you a few leg options in the trousers, but the cut changes if you shorten them. It makes a big difference. I mean, you have, when you bend your knee, the flares has got to be there, but not when you stand up. They're not that, they were subtle flares, like French, I suppose, the cut, of the, depending on how you bent your elbow or knee in these clothes, you know, this is later than this period of time, but it showed a flare that wasn't there because they were parallel. And that was how Levi's were, they were parallel and quite thick. Yeah, but Jelly was actually talking about another maker called Dickies. Dickies make better jeans. Another, it's a US brand, and they were not very common at all, and so they're in, they were to be sought after. Yeah, but anyway, I think he had jeans and something like a zip up, like a flying jacket. I'm sure it's. Jelly would remember, but I think it was like a flying jacket.
He wouldn't remember when he first wore his red suede jacket. Would that have been at that time?
No, later. I think he stole it. Did he tell you that he bought it? I think he stole that. But it didn't really matter. He stole a lot of things then. After we'd gone to London a few times, you see, the morning after, wherever we went, whether it's the scene or the Last Chance or Whiskey A Go-Go or anywhere like that, in the morning it was just customary to go to Petticoat Lane, where there was a series of, you know, I suppose, shonky dealers, you know. We often went to London, nearly every weekend, I should imagine. And after we'd gone to all these nightclubs, whatever they were, the discos, I went to Petticoat Lane, and even early, maybe 6 o'clock in the morning, and it was just full of people, all like us, basically, buying clothes. Now, whether they were stolen or whatever, nobody cared. And so there was fellas selling leather coats, lots of leather, you know, full length leathers and all sorts of things. We all bought, or some of us bought one. I think Jack bought one to start off with. In fact, I remember Jack buying a white one, a white leather with a tie belt. But anyway, because Jelly never had much money. But we went to thousands of parties as well. I think he stole it from a party. And I bought one in Leicester, I think, a brown suede, just in the shape of a normal jacket, about the same time. So this is, I don't know what year, maybe. So early, 64, 65, something like that. And then Jelly turned up with this in a red suede. It was quite effeminate, really, wasn't it? And it was a bit long for him, a bit big for him. But that was okay, he liked things baggy. So we all had a leather, I mean, leather or suede for a long time. I had a black leather Levi jacket made by John Michael. Paris made black suede Levi jacket. I wore it so much it had worn smooth. Yeah. Well, okay, the white suit was later on, so I'd already been just come back from working in Newquay for the season with Steph and Jelly, and so that would have been maybe 65 or 66. white suit was a Junix. Said it was made in Sweden, but designed somewhere else. Like most of this stuff was French, I'm sure it was. And it was a new man-made fibre, probably some polyester blend with something else that was crease-resistant, stain-resistant, you name it. And it wasn't stain-resistant because I know I had a bright green, or green, British Racing green, I suppose, Fred Perry, you know, with three buttons. And I remember this going one night and getting really sweaty and that sort of colour ran out of this thing under the arms and nearly ruined the suit. So my mum had to bleach it, you know, to get this green stain from under the armpits. So it wasn't what it cracked out to be, but it looked very nice. And the car was an AC 2-litre, 1949. Very nice car. It had 17-inch wheels, spoke wheels, and triple SU carburetor and everything like that. But it was a bit of a wreck. It was hard to stop. The brakes weren't good. In fact, nothing was really good on it except that it looked good, which is all that mattered at the time. And all these other places then opened all over town, all the all-nighters. The El Paso, which was just further along up Princess Road, that opened around about that time. And there's a pinball machine in there, that's just an ordinary coffee bar with one pinball machine. And of course the Farinas were on them, you know, the family, Jimmy King, they were always playing. In fact, that particular hop was in a rifle range, an indoor one, you know, which is a long, long corridor, maybe 50 metres long, very low ceiling, soundproof, no windows, with a band at one end. It was absolutely marvellous, because the sound was unreal. You didn't need volume, because there was nowhere else for the sound to go, so it was always, you know, that was very, very good, hot and sweaty, and, you know. I enjoyed that because it was all our generation.
You better stop letting your conscience be your guide. You better stop letting your conscience be your guide. You better stop letting your conscience be your guide. One day you're gonna cause you to run and hide. You better stop letting your conscience be your guide.
Laboratory assistant, and I was fired, you know, for being late, consistently late. And I couldn't understand that. You know, I said, what does 5 minutes make in a man's life? You know, as if the intensity of the work had changed, you know. Drugs helped a bit, I suppose. Maybe they were just an appendage. Appendage.
Pills first.
Yeah. Which weren't illegal at the time, I don't think. I think you'll find that they... Yeah, amphetamines were quite I don't know what you call it, an issue. Because we always thought that anything that gave us any pleasure, the authorities seemed to stamp a prohibition on it. Amphetamines were the first, I think. It wasn't a dangerous drug until they found that people were taking it willy-nilly and doing damage to themselves. So they made that a prohibited substance. And then there was another one that the fishermen used called hemp seed. They used hemp seed to catch little fish in the canal down there and sold it in the fishing shop. But you can actually plant and grow things. And you can also crush them down and smoke it. And everybody was doing that. And it was called Morning Glory. And everybody was smoking that and getting high. So they took those off the market. And the fishermen would... going to rebel against that because they were unable to catch the fish they were taking. Had to go back to using worms and maggots and things. Yeah. Well, that was a great time. He told me the other day that that was one of the highlights because we were wealthy, you know.
The two of you went to live in London. You just had to try it out.
We first went to Jersey together. We went to live in Jersey, and we did very well there. Jelly, I think, he broke his probation. I know that he only told me the other day. I didn't know. He never told me about his probation. So he broke it because he had to report every week to see his probation officer. We went to Jersey, which is a place where there's no poor people, there's no poverty. You could buy a Rolex watch for £100 and things like that. Really nice place. We had a beautiful flat on the top of this block, you know, like a massive studio room with a gable room, high ceiling, just one huge room. You used to nip down and buy Beaujolais nearly every second day, take your bottle down to be filled up in Beaujolais. And we were there a fair number of months. We joined the scene there with all these rich kids, you know, really wealthy there. I mean, it's a wealthy...
And how could you pay for this at the time?
At the time, it was sort of illegal. It was, we, you know, Jelly had sold a lot of drugs, I think, really. At the time, I mean, it wasn't... And so, we had lots of money. And there was people looking after Jelly, this old gay that was sort of cooking for Jelly for some reason. He was the chef at this Hotel de la Plage, but he liked Jelly, you know, this cuddly little fella. And we went out to, I forget the names of the clubs there, they were nice clubs, sort of reminiscent of what you see in a movie, you know, with small tables and like a cabaret type places, you know. So that was good. Anyway, when that finished, we came back. We got a place in London, in Clapham, in Hazelrigg Road, and the flat. And we knew these two girls called Jackie and Linda that lived in a below ground flat, or, you know, not ground floor, but one down. It was quite cold in the winter, but quite cosy in the summer. And we used to go down to London with them. They used to love dancing, these two. They were from Leicester. Quite attractive and stylish women, and taller than both of us. They were both taller, you know, but motherly, you know, looked after us. And Jelly used to shoot back to Leicester every now and again, see a friend, because he used to work at Butler's, and buy huge quantities of amphetamine, like shoeboxes for like thousands at a time. And I didn't even know how much he paid, because he used to just say he's going up to Leicester and I'd be wandering about London, and he'd come back with a shoebox. We used to go down to Woolies and buy these little envelopes about this size or half that size from Woolies and put either 10 or 20 in, seal them all down, have them all in packets like this, load up me, because Jelly was absolutely paranoid about being caught, and we used to go to this club in Seven Sisters Road called the Norique. Really tough place, but it was a very good club. And I remember I had a fawn, like a hunting jacket, cavalry twill, you know, nice beigey colour with big flaps on the pockets and side vents. Looked quite, it was my favourite jacket, as a matter of fact. I bought it from Leicester Market for about 10 bob or something like that. And but it wasn't wasted like most of them are. It was slightly wasted, you know, some of them were heavily wasted, you know. This one wasn't, and, you know, they had good clothes then, I must admit, I bought the best stuff. And so did Jelly. So it looked like $1 million going into this place. In fact, I had a pair of interlaced shoes, you know, casuals, really nice, very comfortable shoes, and light-coloured socks, you know. And as soon as we appeared in the door, I got rushed, you know, to go into the toilet and distribute all these drugs. Pockets full of money. Huge numbers of money, you know, I mean, like, I don't know, let's say 300 or 400 quid in like 50. The average weekly wage was like £8. And then shoot out of this place because it was dangerous, you know, because everybody knew that you had a lot of money. Because when they come to ask for, you know, some pills or something, you didn't have any. That meant you had the money. And so we got a cab and went back home and hid the money in the flat and then come back to the club and had a good time and did some other clubs and spent a lot of money. We spent money like water. But it was a happy time, it really was. I mean, you know, it's only in retrospect you get frightened of, you know, what could have happened. Yeah, so that was the Norique and Seven Sisters Road. I mean, just Seven Sisters Road is a rough, I mean, I don't know what it's like now, but it was the darkest depths of sort of...
Why would you have sorted that particular club out? You didn't go to the, like, the scene or the West End club?
No, because there were so many other people doing the same business, you see. You'd step onto somebody else's patch or scene or whatever it was there. You couldn't do that. That was not a nice thing to do. And there were tough guys down there that wouldn't allow you to do it. But when we first went to the Norique was to see the animals. The animals, and it was so good, the show was so good, you know, we're talking to some of the local boys and they told us about this serious shortage of drugs and we said, oh, you can solve that, that's not a problem. And they said, well, if you can, you know, you're in. I said, well, doesn't anybody, and they said, no, so we just steal cars. They said, we just steal cars, minis, specialised in minis, just for fun, you know, no other reason. And so that's when we arranged to do this. And we said we should do it professionally and put them in envelopes and things instead of... Because you're fumbling with these things, you know, in your pockets. It's not good, is it? Besides being hygienic, you know, doing this in the toilet. This was the age of sort of amphetamine. So it was either dexamphetamine or dexedrine or adrenaline. Blue ones you could sell for a lot more, you see. And this is the irony of it, that... It depended on the drug company as to what colour these things were. I've only realised this afterwards, that because you called them double blues was because they were blue. And people knew what they were by the colour and the shape of the things. To a drug company, that means nothing. They make them all different colours and all different shapes and make the same thing in yellow if they wanted to, or pink. Wouldn't have mattered. In fact, different drug companies make them... different colours, just to identify the drug company with the drug itself, you know, so whatever you buy, pack it off, which is a bit silly really. I mean, if we'd have got any sense, we should have coloured them all blue, and then there would have been, because it was the same effect, same, you know, 100 milligrams of amphetamine or whatever was in these things. How they were presented and what they were mixed with was immaterial, but because people had to recognise these things to know that they were safe, I suppose, that they had them before and they knew that they were okay. I mean, nowadays you don't know. It's a white powder, it could be anything. It could be Ajax. So, and we were, you know, they relied on us. And they knew that we didn't have any trouble from anybody. And that's probably why we were reliable. Oh. turned up with this in a red suede. It was quite effeminate, really, wasn't it? And it was a bit long for him, a bit big for him. But that was okay. He liked things baggy. So we all had a leather, I think.
You wouldn't remember when he first wore his red suede jacket. Would that have been at that time?
No, later. I think he stole it. Did he tell you that he bought it? I think he stole that. But it didn't really matter. We stole a lot of things then.
And it was pink suede with a leather collar on it. Three buttons. Or maybe two, I don't know. Like a suit jacket with a pink suede collar.
Yeah.
Jelly was walking around in a pink suede jacket and then the 501.
The red suede jacket on, with like canaries in cages and jumping up and down and speeding and dancing in the streets and Chile. There almost isn't a time. It was as if it was, you know, meant to happen. There almost isn't a time to meet Chile. Chile was just there.
The red suede jacket.
Which wasn't red, for a start.
What colour was it?
It was like a orange carmine colour.
I didn't see any orange in it at all.
Yeah, well, it was not really red.
No, I saw it as being pink.
Yeah.
Never left.
Jack borrowed it quite a few times.
Yeah, it did end up in Coventry.